It's November, and to paraphrase Alfred Lord Tennyson, in fall a young man's fancy turns to thoughts of sports, or since one of our films is British, sport. And since we are still in quarantine, what better idea than to combine sports with prison? Sounds like the perfect time for episode 32 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your stick this in your trophy case host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. I'm especially looking for more reviews on iTunes, and I'd love to know what you think. Today, I am happy to welcome back a previous guest, film enthusiast, creator of the Film A Day blog, and host of the Lambcast podcast, Richard Kirkham, who has chosen the Robert Aldrich-directed Burt Reynolds vehicle, The Longest Yard, and I have chosen the angry young man, Tony Richardson drama, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, both about sports and prison. To begin, Richard, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
Well, Howard, I'm a longtime film enthusiast. I grew up in the 1970s, and so that's my milieu, the place that I hang out the most. I recently became the main co-host of the Lambcast. I've been co-host for 2.5 years. I am now the director. That's always been something that I've enjoyed doing.
Great. With that, let's get to your selection, The Longest Yard. First, some information about the film. The Longest Yard is an American film that was released in 1974. It was directed by Robert Aldrich and written by Tracy Keenan Wynn, based on a story by the producer Albert S. Rudy. It stars Burt Reynolds, Eddie Albert, Ed Lauter, Michael Conrad, James Hampton, Harry Caesar, John Steadman, Ian Nicholson, Bernadette Peters, and who could possibly miss Richard Kiel. The basic premise revolves around a once-famous quarterback now fallen from grace. When he has an argument with the woman who is keeping him, he takes her car and gets in a fight with the police officer, sending him to prison. But a warden who has a football team made up of his guards arranges to have the quarterback transferred to his prison in an effort to have the quarterback create a semi-pro champion team. But the conflicts lead to a game between the guards and the prisoners in which more than the game is at stake. Why did you choose this film?
We were looking for something at Thanksgiving time, and it's very hard to find a Thanksgiving-related film. But
that
it's
is
also
so true.
It's also football season. We weren't sure if we were going to get a football season, and this just seemed like it was a good film for the time period. I also like the idea that we are sort of all prisoners right now when it comes to COVID. So we have to operate within a variety of limitations. So football and the limitations, that just seemed like a natural choice. I also, like I mentioned a second ago, it's a 1970s film. That's its pedigree, the kind of movies that I still love and love to talk about. And to be honest, it's got a huge entertainment value to it. It's a pretty widely known film. There was an American remake a few years ago with Adam Sandler, which is not very good. And I was recently on the Lambcast where we talked about Mean Machine, which is the English remake of the film done in what they would refer to as football. We would call it soccer.
It's now association football.
Yes. And it was a very faithful remake. So it was just very fortuitous that we picked this film at this time.
When did you first see it?
In 1974, I was 16 years old. I went with my best friend, Arthur Franz. We saw it at the Garfield Theater in Alhambra, the town that I grew up in, right outside of Los Angeles. It was a lot of fun. One of those movies that is perfect for a 16-year-old. Racy enough with the language and the violence, but it's not really outside of anything that's in the acceptable norms kind of thing. I also saw it a few years ago at the TCM Film Festival. Burt Reynolds was originally scheduled to be at the screening, but apparently there was an illness. This was before he passed away, obviously.
Let us hope so.
Yeah. He wasn't able to make it, but Albert Ruddy was there. Joe Capp, who is one of the football players who appeared in the film as the walking boss, was also there. And so that was a fun time talking about the film.
What were your first impressions upon seeing it?
When you're a kid, you love all of those moments in the film that make you laugh. You mentioned Richard Kiel is in the movie. people who aren't familiar with the name know him as Jaws from the James Bond films. He has a line during the football game that every 16-year-old could repeat, but we won't do that because this is a family-friendly show here. The character actors in the film were all people that I was kind of familiar with and knew from multiple television shows, movies that I'd seen. And I love that kind of stuff. And I'm a football fan. A bunch of the players who were in the cons and the guards were former football players also. It was cool to see them too. And so
including Burt Reynolds.
Yes. Florida State, I believe. It was a group of people that were athletes and character actors. Even though Burt Reynolds is the star, and it's very clear that he's the star, there's a good ensemble in this film. Everybody gets a moment or two to shine in it. Even the villain, Eddie Albert, gets his chance to practically lick his lips, and if he had a mustache, twirl it a little bit.
If there were any curtains in that prison, there aren't now because he chewed them up really well.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm sure that I saw it more than once that summer because I would go to the movies all the time. Unlike some people I know, I'd see the same film over and over again in a theater. I'm happy to do that.
What did you think upon seeing it again? Do you think it still holds up?
I think it does hold up. My post from 4 years ago from the TCM Film Festival, I said I thought it held up. I do think that there are some questions about the PC attitude that is prevalent now. The language is there. There's some racial tension in the film. I think the racial tension is probably still existent, but the way it is spoken about probably is not so appealing here. But the football stuff works. The anti-authoritarian message probably worked a little bit better in the early 70s than it does now, but I think you could probably find a way it would translate to a contemporary audience also. If the right people are watching it, I think they would get it.
This is actually the first time I saw it. I did not see it when it came out. I think the main reason why I didn't is that I think I was growing just tired of Burt Reynolds. He was never a great actor. I don't think anybody is ever going to say he was the Laurence Olivier or Daniel Day-Lewis. But instead of trying to expand his range as he did with such films as Deliverance and The End, which is a movie I believe he directed himself about someone who is told that he is going to die. It's a comedy. Films like that, I believe Starting Over is one with Jill Clayburgh. He just pretty much went the Smokey and the Bandit way. And eventually I got a little tired of him and I wasn't that enthusiastic in seeing his films. I'm also not a big sports person and I'm not a big prisons person. So I think at the time that was pretty much a death knell for really wanting to see the film. And it also represented the kind of film I was trying to get away with. This was a big budget Hollywood studio type film. By the time it came out, people of my generation who were really interested in films were just getting tired of them. They weren't as interesting as foreign films or independent films, films of that nature. I think it's very enjoyable. I certainly was very entertained by it. I don't think I'm as big an enthusiast as you are, perhaps because there weren't very many surprises and I knew pretty much what was going to happen. The direction, I'm not convinced, is that particularly interesting. But overall, I think it's a very entertaining and very enjoyable film, and it was certainly a very popular film. It did make a lot of money.
It was very successful. Yeah, I think the artistic elements of it are limited. It's an effective entertainment. It builds the audience into the story the way we're being led. I don't think there are big surprises in the film, but there are moments that are surprisingly intense, and there are a couple of side elements to it that I think take it in darker directions than you might imagine. And like I said before, I think all the character actors get a chance to shine a little bit.
That is one of the enjoyable things about the movie, because as you're going through it, you're going, oh, I know him. I know him. Yeah. And a lot of them became much bigger after this film. Even though they might have been familiar at the time, they really became much, much bigger, mainly due to television series and things of that nature.
Right. Ed Lauder has always been a favorite of mine. He's just an interesting looking guy who got cast in a lot of roles as cops, military guys. He's the head prison guard here. He's also the captain of the guards team. I think one of his biggest parts in films, he only passed away a couple of years ago and he was working right up till the end. It was, I think, a good part for him. James Hampton is an interesting character actor that didn't have quite as much success in movies as I think he did on television. division. I thought this was a good part for him. Charles Tyner is kind of the villain or the secondary villain in the film. He was in everything in the 70s. He was always lurking in the background of the scenes in different movies, westerns, a lot of gritty films that you remember from the 1970s. Burt Reynolds has charisma to spare. I think you're right. He started cruising on that charisma a lot, especially after the success of Smokey and the Bandit. He tried a lot of things. I think he was a solid actor. He wasn't necessarily an accomplished thespian, but he was certainly capable of conveying dramatic characteristics as well as the comedic. But once Smokey and the Bandit came along, it's all smiling and grinning most of the time. And I think for a 10-year period after that, that's the kind of movie that he did. It put him into a niche that a lot of people, like you, probably didn't care much for. Later on in his career, I think he did a few more films that I think are worthy. Breaking In and, of course, Paul Thomas Anderson film Boogie Nights are good examples of that.
Those are probably his two best films outside of Deliverance.
I also liked him in the Russell Crowe film Mystery Alaska.
Which was another one I still haven't seen, but it's sports.
Yes.
But I do like you mentioning Breaking In. That is a movie that I think most people have no idea exists.
Yes.
Of course, he hated Paul Thomas Anderson, regretted being in the film, Boogie Nights.
He was very frustrated about
that. And
it was a good performance.
It's probably his best performance. And he gets the Oscar nomination for it. And you're sort of going, you're being kind of, I can't say what it is. This is a family show. You're being a little ungrateful here.
Yes. Ungracious is maybe the way to say it.
He's doing Marlon Brando, but he doesn't quite have the chops of Marlon Brando to get away with it. What are some of your favorite scenes in the movie?
The football scenes are the things that are the most fun, but I think everybody likes the scene where Paul Crewe, the character being played by Burt Reynolds, and Caretaker, the James Hampton character, are on the field and they're evaluating the prisoners' skill levels. He's giving them a number as they're running through a variety of tests. This is one of those places where his charisma comes through and sells a character, even though there isn't much of the character there. It's personality that adds a lot to this. Having recently seen the Mean Machine, where Vinnie Jones, who is an English footballer, steps into that role. He carries the footballer part, but the charisma, he's charisma free for the most part.
That's a great phrase. I have to remember that phrase. He's charisma free.
He's kind of a glowering figure. He sells the idea that he's a football player, but he doesn't have an appeal. He doesn't have that attitude that sells the comedy in that moment. But all the football stuff works. Some of the conversations that he has with Caretaker, those things work pretty well also. When the football game comes up, everybody knows how these sports movies go. This is actually, I think, one of the films that is largely responsible for the wave of sports movies we got in the 1970s. Everybody points to Rocky. They get the idea that there's a Rocky story going on there. This came out 2 years before Rocky, and I think it really is the starting point. There have been other sports films before, but subsequent to this, you got the Bad News Bears, Rocky films, you've got Slapstick, a whole bunch of other films that featured sports. Underdogs overcoming the more authoritarian or more powerful teams. There's literally a decade of those kinds of movies that come out.
I think you said something interesting in that films like Rocky and the Bad News Bears and even Slapstick, I do think there is a difference between them. And the main one is The Longest Yard is mainly a fight against the authority. It's against Eddie Albert and what prison represents. Rocky and the Bad News Bears is more against, I want to say, the sport itself and the way it's set up and against an inner conflict. For Rocky, it's an inner conflict. He just wants respect. The Bad News Bears, they also want respect, but their main problem is the snobbish other teams, the main team that wins. Slapstick is just an all-out assault on the way hockey is run. So none of those are really against authoritarianism. This is an all-out assault on authoritarianism.
Yes.
And probably could even be seen to some degree, and this might be an interesting parallel in a way when we get to talking about the loneliness of the long-distance runner. Is it about prison, or can it be a parallel to the way all football players are treated? With the differences that football players have outside of prison have a lot more options, and they have used those options until now they have a lot more control.
Well,
Does that make sense?
I think I see where you're headed there, and I think there is probably some truth about that. There's always been an anti-authoritarian element to all of these games where people are engaged in physical contact in the game. We're talking about a football movie right here. I'm thinking about North Dallas 40 as a good illustration of that in the professional football league, resisting the control of the owners and the coaches. There's a different degree of personal autonomy and freedom that exists there. The parallel to the prison, I think, is not a bad way to look at that and see how that might be connected to it. That's an interesting point.
Some of my favorite scenes, I love the female impersonating cheerleaders and the pep squad. I thought those were great. And the look on Eddie Albert's face, he feels so embarrassed. Oh, what can he do? I love the split screen. The only disappointment I have with the split screen is that it was used so little.
There was another period of time between 1966 and 1975 where split screen was used quite a bit. This was, I think, a pretty effective use, and you are right, they used it in a limited number of circumstances. I think it might have worked a little bit more in the football scenes if they'd done that. It had a good build-up to the emotions that you were talking about at the start of the game when the different teams are coming out and the attitudes that are being conveyed in the different set of the screen.
I thought it was such a good idea that it could have been used a lot more. Like the Boston Strangler uses split screen quite a bit. And then, of course, Brian De Palma uses... A different kind of split screen, showing the same scene from different angles.
Right.
And of course, who can dislike Bernadette Peters' big hair?
Yes. Are there spiders in there?
Yes.
That was a big beehive hairdo.
There was an alternative ending. I don't think they shot it. This is where Eddie Albert has Ed Lauder kill Crewe as he's going to pick up the game ball.
Yeah, I could see where somebody, when they wrote that, they thought about the film and they said, well, there's this anti-authoritarian thing, but the authorities always win in the end. That, of course, would have killed the movie's chances of success. Nobody wants to see that downer.
The problem with using that ending, which was the original ending in the script, is once you put Burt Reynolds in the movie, and once you make it more of a light comedy, that ending just doesn't quite work.
It would be completely different from the tone of the rest of the film at that point. There is one other element of the film that might have mirrored that, but I think it would be such a downer to what they had created in all of the other characters that it doesn't make much sense. I understand the impulse to do it kind of gives your film this serious payoff at the end, but it seems to contradict what you were giving the audience for the previous 90 minutes.
Reynolds said something that might feed into this. Reynolds said that Aldrich knew that comedy was not his strong suit. So they would do a take as written. Then Aldrich would ask for a shtick take where Reynolds would clown around. And Reynolds said that by the time the film was finished, that they used these shtick scenes about 65% of the time. Once you start doing that, that does change the tone of the whole movie. It's no longer even that much of a dark comedy.
Right. Maybe the parallel is MASH, where you get a lot of setup and then you have a football game at the end. There's a lot of comedy in all of the film, but it's certainly set in a very serious circumstance. We're in a prison, after all, and these guys, some of them are murderers and killers. And that's why they're in prison. And here we are supposedly laughing at those kinds of things. You do have to take it all with a big grain of salt to be able to enjoy it, but I think the shtick worked.
It's interesting you talk about them being filled with murderers and killers. Some of the scenes I enjoyed when they were discussing who they wanted on the football team. Well, they wanted the killers and the murderers. The more psycho, the better.
When they go and get Bob Tessier, who's the isolated killer, they have that conversation. He killed 5 people. Burt Reynolds says, that karate's bad stuff. He says, that was before he learned karate.
Yes.
This is one of those kinds of things where we're going to take the absurd and elevate it a little bit to add to the humor of the movie.
And you're right, if they had used the ending where Burt Reynolds was shot, I think it would have been a box office disaster.
It would have been a mess. And I think it would undermine the other themes in the movie about sports and redemption of the characters. We've already had the movie where the prisoner gets shot at the end. I'll mention that at the end when we get to the end of the show.
We were talking about Burt Reynolds as an actor. There is also a quote from Aldrich about Reynolds. And he said that on occasion, he's a much better actor than he's given credit for. Not always. Sometimes he acts like a caricature of himself. I thought he was very good in Longest Yard. think that reflects what we were saying about Burt Reynolds. He could have been a better actor, but somewhere along the line, he seemed to have chosen not to be so much.
I think that that's true. He did that TV series, and I've heard very good things about it. I never saw it. Evening Shade was the show right. That he did. And I think that ran for 7 or 8 years, and I heard very good things about it. I never saw it, so I don't know how good he was in the mid to late part of his career there when he was doing that. But yes, I think he was capable of being more than he was, but he was also enjoying a great deal of success being the clown that he was, too.
Mm-hmm. Are you a Robert Aldridge fan?
I seem to remember I've seen other films that he's done. Did he do The Dirty Dozen?
Yes.
That's probably the main one that I'm familiar with. I should have had that tattooed in my brain. I was pretty sure about that. That's another film where they take killers and they turn them into comic characters sometimes. John Cassavetes and Donald Sutherland are supposed to be psychos in that movie. They're often comic relief, too.
He also did, which is perhaps my favorite of his, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
I've seen that. I hadn't realized that he was the director on that, but now that I think about it, I think I do remember that. That's an entertaining film, too, with some fun performances.
He was credited for starting the crazy old ladies trend of movies.
I could see that. Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte came later.
There was Sue Slew, Auntie Rue.
What's the Matter with Helen?
All very entertaining, actually. All quite a bit of fun. But it was a very, very odd trend. He also did the very cult popular Kiss Me Deadly. I don't quite get the cult popularity of it. I don't think it quite works, but people love it. He also did The Flight of the Phoenix, which is one of his better films. So he's a very solid director, craftsman-like, skilled director. Perhaps he never really rose much above that.
Well, he certainly seemed to be successful when he had ensemble casts. I knew him from someplace else. He did Emperor of the North, which is another film that I really like.
You said that you attended a screening at TCM. Were there any little tidbits that were revealed?
There were a couple of things. Albert Ruddy talked about how the guys who were playing the guards actually got arrested one night before they were shooting because of the kind of thing that you would expect, drinking in a bar, having an altercation. They were prisoners one night and prison guards the next day when they were shooting. So I thought that was kind of fun. It wasn't about the film itself. Joe Capp was at the presentation. He was interesting to listen to. He was 78 at the time. And this is 4 years ago. I'm not even sure if he's still alive. He was a little out of it. He doesn't hear very well. He wasn't really responding to the questions and the prompts that he was getting from the host and from Albert Ruddy. He told a couple of good stories about working with the football players and having fun on that. We shouldn't forget, but Albert Ruddy, of course, was the Academy Award-winning producer of The Godfather. He was also producer of Million Dollar Baby, so he's a two-time Academy Award-winning producer.
Sometimes when actors get to a certain age and they are having either health problems like that or problems with their memories, what their agent does or what their manager does is make them memorize a couple of stories, and it doesn't matter what they're asked.
They'll just tell the story.
They just tell the story. Peter O'Toole was like that when he was making the rounds for his film Venus. He obviously was not answering the questions he was being asked, but would just tell some story. And generally, you didn't care.
Well, you know, you're getting to listen to Peter O'Toole or whoever talk, and you just say, I'll just enjoy the moment that I have instead of worrying about the moment that I wanted to create.
Right. With that, here's some more information about the movie. It cost $2.9 million to make and made $43 million at the box office. So it was a very successful film. The film has been remade 3 times. As the 2001 British film Mean Machine, which you mentioned with Vinnie Jones. Also, as you mentioned, the 2005 remake with Adam Sandler and with Burt Reynolds as Coach Nate Scarborough. But it also was remade as the 2015 Egyptian film Captain Masseur, and of course, it's changed from American football to association football or soccer. And though the film is billed as being based on an original story, some reviewers found parallels between this film and a 1962 Hungarian film called Two Half Times in Hell, which was based on a real-life association football game in 1942 between German soldiers and Ukrainian prisoners of war during World War II. This was known as the Death Match, and it was later remade in the U.S. as Escape to Victory.
I think it was released as Escape to Victory in other parts of the world, but in the U.S., it was just called Victory.
Yes, it was called a lot of other things too, but this is a family show, so we won't get into that. Tracy Keenan Wynn, who wrote the script, was chosen because he had written a TV movie about life in prison, The Glass, which was one of the early films that brought Alan Alda.
I was going to say, that, was it Vic Morrow who was the heavy in that? I remember the ending of the movie, and it was a downer.
Right. Tracy Keenan Wynn is the great-grandson of Frank Keenan. He's the grandson of Ed Wynn, the comedian, and the son of Keenan Wynn, the comedian, the younger brother of Ned Wynn, and he's, of all things, the stepson of Van Johnson.
That's an interesting pedigree that he comes from.
The film won the Golden Globe Award for Best Motion Picture Musical Comedy in 1975. Reynolds was nominated for Actor. Eddie Albert was nominated for Supporting Actor. James Hampton was nominated for New Star of the Year. The film was also nominated for an Academy Award for Film Editing. We mentioned some of the actors in it, but we, of course, can't forget Michael Conrad, who really came to prominence in Hill Street Blues. Sports Illustrated Rick Taylander wrote in the October 17, 1988 issue, after the cast and crew had departed from Georgia State Prison, the inmates played Georgia State Troopers using the equipment left behind by the film crew. But the game quickly got out of hand, with inmates pummeling the out-of-shape troopers for their alleged arrogance. The game was called At the Half, with the inmates ahead 66-0 in their prison football in Georgia. And Burt Reynolds' brother is the player wearing the black jersey number 65, seen running beside Reynolds in the final play of the game. With that, let's get to my selection, and that is The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. First, some information about the film. The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner is a British film released in 1962. It was directed by Tony Richardson and written by Alan Sillitoe, based upon his 1959 short story of the same name. It stars Michael Redgrave, Tom Courtney, Avis Bunnage, Alec McCowan, James Bolin, Joe Robinson, Julia Foster, James Fox, John Thaw, Derek Fowles. The basic premise revolves around a teenager who has been arrested for robbing a bakery and is sent to a borstal, or a juvenile detention center. It soon becomes clear that he has a talent for running. The head of the institution is preparing for a game stay against a posh boarding school not far away. He's desperate to win the games and places all of his hope on this young man's ability to run long distances. What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
It's an interesting pairing because it is prison films. They both have that in common. They both deal with the authoritarian element quite a bit. This film, I think, is obviously a lot more serious. It responds to the issue in a very different way. It probably is emblematic of a lot of films of the 60s where the tone is more serious, and the 70s, when they deal with the authoritarian tendency, tend to go the comic route, like we talked about with MASH and The Longest Yard. This one is, I don't want to say it's a downer per se, but it's one of those angry young men kitchen dramas from Great Britain in the 60s, and I think there's a reason that it works, and the fact that it's set in a prison and it involves an athletic competition, that I thought was a pretty creative way of connecting the two things together. I enjoyed that. We didn't just go for another football film. We went for something that really fits into the particular setting of the movie. I think that worked.
When did you first see the film?
Yesterday.
Okay. I beat you. I watched The Longest Yard last Tuesday or Wednesday.
I've heard of the film for a long time. I know Tom Courtney. I've seen him in lots of things. It's not that I avoided the film. It just never jumped up and said, oh, watch me. One of the reasons that I like doing a show like this is that it does take me places that I wouldn't normally go. It gives me a chance to see some things that I've missed or blind spots that a film enthusiast ought to have in their background.
That works for me, too, because I had never seen The Longest Day. For some reason, I'd never seen Dumb and Dumber. I had never seen Constantine. And there were a couple of others that, for whatever reason, I had never seen. So it works the same way for me.
Good.
What did you think of the film when you saw it?
I liked it pretty well. I do think that probably because I've seen movies like this and we were talking about prison movies, I had a general inclination of where it was going to go in the long run. It was an interesting structure about the film. I was a little surprised about that because it's not quite linear. It's told in a flashback style, and the flashbacks are really long segments where we get big background on the lead character, and then we jump back into the incarceration prison story a little bit. I think if I counted the amount of minutes that the film took up with the prison elements, that would probably be less than half of the movie, and you kind of think, well, if I'm going to see a prison movie, most of it's going to take place in the prison, but I don't think it works that way in this film.
No, that's true. Even though I had seen it before, I think I was a little surprised at that too upon seeing it a second time. It could be half and half, but you're right.
I was seeing it streaming, so I assume that I'm seeing the version that is widely available. I don't know what the aspect ratio was when they shot it. It looked to me like it was a 16 millimeter blown up to a 35 millimeter, but the aspect ratio is standard television. 1:3, not 2:3:5. It's not a widescreen presentation. It didn't need to be. There weren't any scenes of running that needed to have that widescreen effect. It looked very primitivist. It's shot in an interesting way with the lighting. That's an interesting thing about the film. I will be honest with you, I did the same thing for Mean Machine when we were talking about it on the Lambcast. I watched the film partway through. I turned on the closed captions so that I could make out some of the language.
I never have them on.
Oh, okay.
I even have them on for American shows. But if it's British, those closed captions are going on.
Yes. Well, it's one of those things where I knew most of the references I understood, but sometimes they're speaking so fast, there's such a heavy accent that you can't quite make out what was being said. And that I found to be especially true in those domestic scenes with his mother and the other kids screaming. And I'm going, wait, what's happening here? It was easier to understand, actually, when they were in the juvenile facility. It really felt a little bit more like it was just one person at a time talking, even though there is a writer. Scene.
Right, which apparently they used a lot of real people in the juvenile detention home.
Right.
And they seem to enjoy doing it very, very much. I can't remember when I first saw it. Probably I saw it when it was on DVD, and I probably rented it at some time. I like the film very, very much. I think I like it a lot more than you do, but I think it is close to my sort of film. It's a bit more character-driven. The dialogue is a lot stronger. I find the story a bit more interesting. I like a lot of the kitchen scene, the Angry Young Man films of the time. Though I'd have to say I do sometimes find them a bit frustrating because I often ask, well, you're angry, but what do you want?
Yes, yes. This was the drawback that I had to the film. I found the character that Tom Courtenay's portraying compelling and interesting. You got a lot of insight into what his life was like at home. And I think he's got an interesting relationship with his mate and the girl that he falls in with. He's got a conflicted relationship with his mother and the family. I found all of that really fascinating. However, at the end, when we're discovering that he's angry enough to do what he does, I keep thinking it's like self-destruction all over again. Apparently, you just can't get out of the pattern. And that's maybe the point of the movie, that there's no escaping. If you're going to feel like you need to be an anti-authoritarian in every situation, then even when an opportunity presents itself where there's a chance for you to advance or change, you have to be true to yourself. I guess that's the way that they would promote it in the film. I found it a little bit frustrating because there were times when I didn't really see the Michael Redgrave character, who's what they call the governor of the facility. We would call him the warden here, as an evil character. He's certainly not like Eddie Albert in The Longest Yard. He's not malicious, intent on doing wrong to the kids that are there, but he is an authoritarian. He wants to do things a particular way. He's dismissive of the psychologist, but so is our character.
So was I. In one way, I feel like that was one area where the movie falls down. I didn't believe that psychiatrist as a person. But I think some of the things you're saying are quite valid. For much of the film, I was going, well, you're angry, and I would be angry in your situation too. But it's in many ways like a Ken Loach film. So what do you want? Tell me what you want. And often in these kitchen sink dramas and these angry young men dramas, I really don't know what they want. They want to change society, but how? And they hint at it in the movie, but only hint at it. It's when he's out with his girlfriend. He says that his father didn't think that the owners of businesses should have all the money.
When he says that, I thought of another film that I saw Tom Courtney in where he makes almost the same kind of statement, and that's King Rat from 3 or 4 years later, where he's the authoritarian captain in the prison of the British prisoners in a Japanese prison camp, and he's supposed to be running roughshod. It's a pairing, by the way, with James Fox again. It's sort of the same dynamic. James Fox is in the higher class, I guess you would say. Tom Courtney's character is the more working class, and there's a lot of resentment there, even though they are in the military and they have less distinction between them personally. And you got the same sort of thing in this film that we are talking about here, although James Fox's character doesn't come in till right at the end, and he doesn't really have a lot of lines. He's just, I don't want to say a cardboard cutout, but he's the emblem of the upper class that Colin is racing against.
In certain ways, there are two conflicts in the movie. One that perhaps we as Americans can more identify with, and that is this idea that it's the capitalists that are making all the money. They exploit the workers. Tom Courtney thinks, well, this needs to change. The workers need to get more power. But there's also a conflict that's a lot more subtle to Americans, and that's the class conflict. The authoritarianism of Michael Redgrave, who is the governor, is not so much capitalist versus socialist. It's upper class versus working class. The upper class has very strict limits as to what the working class and the lower class can do. And this juvenile hall, even though it purports to be a place where these people can perhaps better their lives, it's really just an institution for the upper classes to make sure that the working class never gets out of the working class.
Well, I think that that's the theme, you know, the writers have in this story, that that's perpetuating this class distinction. I think you're right, by the way, that this is one of those things that maybe American audiences will not pick up on quite as much, because although we do have class distinctions here, they're not nearly the same kind of class differences that they've had for 1,000 years in Great Britain. I'm sure that it's true that people are judged sometimes on their accent in the U.S., but I know, having interacted with people from Great Britain, that the accents distinguish you, that you are a particular class because of the accent that you have when you're speaking. We have much less of that kind of thing here. Ours is maybe more based on economics and ethnicity rather than education, although you do sometimes get that sort of thing.
Right. In the U.S., though we have problems, I mean, we do have problems, our social classes are easier to navigate. It's much easier to go from one social class to another in America than it is in England. Often because social class in England is often not based on how much money you have. It's based on your background.
It's based on your name and your family and the part of the country that you come from.
This sometimes does cause a problem in the movie because it has two conflicts. And which one is driving the movie? Sometimes I think it's confusing. One of the interesting scenes was on the television when some sort of pompous MP or someone like that is giving a script about how great Britain is. And some of the things he lists are pensions and other welfare state. And they make fun of it. And I'm going, no, that's what you want. That's what Tom Courtney should be
going
for.
That's what his character seems to be thinking. But I think that's one of those things that we talked about. I don't think the angry young men really know what they're angry about.
And you're right. He's given an opportunity. As Michael Redgrave says, this is your way out of the working class. You could even go to the Olympics and you could make something of yourself. And this might be an interesting to talk about the difference in the two endings, because both endings say the same thing, but they end very differently.
I think that's true. In essence, the authoritarians win, but in the longest yard, the power seems to be with the prisoners and the Paul Crewe character, because they win the game and stick it in the nose directly because they take the power, whereas Tom Courtney's character surrenders his ability at the end. He's going the opposite direction.
They both say screw you to the warden.
Right, exactly.
But they do it by winning in the longest yard, and Tom Courtney does it by purposely losing.
Right. There's a personal screw you to the Eddie Albert character. He deserves it, given the way he treats the prisoners and given his duplicity in the negotiation that he makes trying to
reneges on his agreement.
Fix the game. Whereas the Michael Redgrave character, even though he represents an authoritarian, has been nothing but sympathetic and supportive to Colin, despite the fact that he is, of course, the authority figure there. Like I said, it felt very different, even though
it is
the same kind of FU.
Right. But he is like Eddie Albert. It's not Tom Courtney's character that he's interested in. I think another aspect of the film that we don't really identify with as much in the U.S. is the time of change, and that this was after World War II. And I'm not sure when rationing had ended, but if you were working class, it could be very difficult. And they were just now making inroads with unions, with getting pensions. I don't know when NIH will start coming into play. The working class is starting to rise up and is starting to make changes. It was very different in the U.S. after the war, where we had pretty much anything and everything that we wanted. In fact, one of the reasons why Britain was doing so poorly after the war is that the U.S. said, you have to pay us back. Britain did pay us back, and it really hurt them.
Let's face it, Great Britain had the brunt of the war on their shoulders.
Right.
We certainly did our part when we finally got involved, but for 2.5 years before we got there, Great Britain was standing alone against everybody, and they had devoted all their resources. They had borrowed money from us to be able to continue to fight. They were being bombed on a regular basis. The war was something that was happening someplace else in the world. I'm not super familiar with the history of Great Britain after the war. It seems to me like that would definitely be a boiling pot for social change. There's a change in the air. Obviously, a lot of filmmakers thought that it was something that they needed to illustrate and talk about.
And there are a lot of movies like this.
Right.
But speaking of the ending, I do find the ending very effective in one way, in that as he is running, we start hearing all this dialogue from scenes that have played in the movie. And he's beginning to come to realize that, in a way, he's being a patsy.
Yeah, I think that that's probably the justification for the decision that he makes at the end. It's the one thing that maybe makes that action feel like it was the right thing to do. Although the very next scene, because there is a coda to this, it's not like in The Longest Yard where the final scenes are the end of the game and them walking off the field. We come back to the school, the reform school, and we see some of the consequences of what's going on. And he's back in the labor manufacturing room doing menial work and being ignored and whatever.
Right.
Has vanished.
You know? Yes, you won, but what did you win?
Right.
Exactly. Also, in connection with The Longest Yard, when I was talking about a metaphor for professional athletes being in a prison at times themselves, Alan Sillitoe also said something to the effect, if I can remember it right, this was also a metaphor for an amateur sportsman becoming pro. When he was running just to run, there was a great joy in his running. There was a freedom. There was a spirituality to it. Once he starts to become a pro, all that leaves him. There's no more meaning to running than to win. Sillitoe, I think, also saw that as a reason why he stopped. He didn't want to lose the joy of running as well. And that's what happens when often amateur athletes become pro athletes. It's no longer about the sport.
It's their job.
It now becomes a job.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of Tony Richardson? Have you seen many of his films?
I was trying to remember some of the other films that I've seen that Tony Richardson did. I'm sure. Let me just do a quick check here because I know that I've seen some.
If there was only someplace we could go and look up this information.
Yes, yes.
But we didn't have to rely on our memory.
Tom Jones is the most famous one, I'm sure. I did see Blue Sky. I did a project several years ago, 2014, called 30 Years On, where I went back and looked at all the movies that I saw in 1984. I think 1984 is one of the great movie years. I saw a lot of films that year, so I went back and looked at all those films in the order in which they came out. Tony Richardson directed The Hotel New Hampshire, which is based on a book that I love, and it's a movie that I didn't care much for. I liked it a little bit better when I saw it for that project. That's a film that he did that I think I could recommend. I never saw The Entertainer completely. I think I saw the first half hour or so of it and didn't finish it.
He's a director that, for me, started out so well because he had something very definite to say. And you see it in the Angry Young films of Look Back in Anger and The Entertainer, Taste of Honey. Even Tom Jones, The Loved One is probably his best American film, if it's exactly an American film. It's filmed in the U.S. But somewhere along the line, he seemed for me to have lost it. And a lot of that has to do when he starts coming to America and he starts doing rather uninteresting films. It's uncredited on Mahogany.
He does The Border. I can understand why you would choose that.
Yes, he did The Border and the whole Hotel New Hampshire. I haven't read the book. The movie has an interesting message, but you're right. It just doesn't really work. Blue Sky, which has a great first half and then a terrible, terrible, terrible second half. He seemed to have lost something I do wonder whether he didn't have anything to say anymore.
That might be true. I think that does happen. It's funny because I know his face so well. In the AMC theaters, they have murals up in the lobby area and outside of the restrooms, big pictures that are like wallpaper that feature actors or actresses or directors. Tony Richardson directing Jessica Lange in Blue Sky was one of those images that took up a whole wall in several of the AMC theaters that I went to that always had him listed there. And I just thought, wow, that's an important film. That's an important filmmaker. And then I look at his list of films and I go, you only had three or four that I think people would say that was an important film. Outside of that, I think you're right, Howard. I think he probably ran out of things to say.
Yes, and couldn't find anything new. And that can be very difficult if you can't reinvent yourself. And then if you come to the U.S. to make movies, that can be the death knell for anybody who had an individuality and an artistry in another country.
It's certainly dependent on when you came to America. If you came in the late 60s or 70s, you were in better shape. But if you came before then, the studio system was still in control. After 77, 78, the vision thing disappeared and it became the money thing again.
Right. Well, with that, here's some more information about the film. It cost 211 pounds to make, but it was a box office disappointment. Michael Redgrave, who played the governor, like Tracy Keenan Wynn, is part of a very famous dynasty in film. He's the son of the silent film star Roy Redgrave, who was a major Australian actor. He was the husband of Rachel Compson. He was the father of Lynn, Corin, and Vanessa Redgrave, the grandfather of Natasha and Jolie Richardson, who are the daughters of the director of this film. I don't know if Michael Redgrave was alive at the time, but he eventually would have been Tony Richardson's father-in-law. John Thaw, who is uncredited, is perhaps most famous now for playing Inspector Morse on the BBC. And we did mention James Fox, who also is uncredited, but he plays the runner from the posh boarding school. He's the brother Edward Fox, who looks so much alike, I'm never sure which one.
Thank you for saying it.
Is which?
I've been a number of times that I'm seeing one of them, especially in the later years, where I go, wait, which one is this one?
He's most famous now, perhaps, for Performance, The Servant, and he was the father of Baroque Assault and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Alec McGowan, who also is uncredited, played Q in Never Say Never Again and the police inspector in Alfred Hitchcock's next-to-last film, Frenzy. And I guess you can also spy Frank Finlay in there. He is much better known later on for The Three Musketeers. In closing out, is there anything you might want to say about this film and about The Longest Yard or both films together?
Obviously, The Longest Yard is an entertainment. The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner is the kind of film that we would match it with. That's the whole point of this podcast that you're doing. I think it's a good pairing. It's an interesting pairing. They're very contrasting styles and tones that you have in the film. I do think that the performances of the lead actors in both films are solid, really very good. Burt Reynolds gets by a lot on his charisma, and Tom Courtney is very effective playing this angry, conflicted young man. He's got an interesting look to him. It's a black and white film also. Don't let that put you off, though, folks. It's definitely a film that I think is worth seeing.
And Tom Courtney did get two Oscar nominations.
Right.
He got an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor for Dr. Zhivago, and he is the best thing in that movie, and got an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for The Dresser alongside Albert Finney. He did not do a lot of film. He preferred to do stage.
Right.
With that, let's start closing out, and I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
Well, I immediately thought of two films, and then there's a third film I want to mention very quickly. The first film that came to mind was Cool Hand Luke. You have a prisoner who is rebellious against authority. His personal charm and charisma is what makes him an interesting character. In that way, he's a lot like the Paul Crewe character, the Burt Reynolds character, but he is also pig-headed in the way he does things. He's not realistic about things. The conclusion of the film is pretty dark in the long run, so it's a little bit more like The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. The other film that I thought of is not set in a prison, but it's about the 70s. It's a sports film, Fat City, with Stacy Keach.
Underrated.
I think it's a fantastic movie. Definitely underrated. I don't think there are a lot of people who know about it. It's a John Huston film. Fantastic. And then the other film that did come to mind in my head, the problem is I haven't seen it since it played on television in 1979, and that's The Jericho Mile.
Right.
With Peter Strauss. That. As a matter of fact, I looked it up today before our show. I've ordered it on Blu-ray. It's going to come tomorrow. It is a film about a guy in prison who is a long-distance runner.
Right.
My memory of the movie was that it was fantastic, but I only saw it the one time in 1979, so it's a very vague memory. Like Duel, it's a film that was made for television in the United States but got released overseas in theaters.
Well, I will recommend both a team sports movie and a prison movie. The team sports movie is Hoosiers, the 1986 film starring Gene Hackman as a coach with a questionable past, arriving at a small Indiana town in 1954 to coach a basketball team at the local high school. This was a really big surprise to me when I saw it. I really wasn't expecting much from it. It's a pretty wonderful film with an incredible film score by Jerry Goldsmith. The prison film is Scum, another English film, a 1979 film starring Ray Winston about life in a juvenile detention center that makes the borstal and loneliness look like a posh boarding school. It's a pretty rough film to watch. What is next? What should we be looking for from you?
I am taking over as the host of the Lambcast. I'm always looking for people who are interested in being on the show to join us. On my own site, I'm continuing to try to keep going to the movie theater alive. I know that a lot of people are locked out of their theaters, like in Los Angeles County.
Right.
I don't want to say it's a crusade, but if those theaters die, you're not going to see all those movies that got pushed back in a theater because there won't be any place to show them.
Well, as for me, I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Howard Kastner Facebook consultation page. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning movies and screenwriting. I've published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are science fiction, horror, and fantasy short stories. I have published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, on Amazon. And I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those photos on Instagram. The previous podcast was with returning guest, founder of the Cathode Ray Mission, Adam Ferenz, where we discussed the films Mad Max Fury Road and A Boy and His Dog, two apocalyptic films about some very strange strangers in some very strange lands. I will then be taking a week off, but will return with another returning guest, blogger and film enthusiast Movie Rob, where we will discuss Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Ballad of a Soldier, both about characters desperate to get home within a certain amount of time, but finding little but obstacles along the way. With that, Richard, I want to say once more, thank you very much for being a guest on the show.
Howard, it's always my pleasure to talk with you, and I hope that your listeners enjoy our discussion.